Hello there, and welcome to the Cider Guide podcast. I am your host, Eric West. In this podcast, I interview personalities from the wide world of apples and cider, and I think I've got a great interview for you this time. This is episode 6. There's been a brief hiatus as I've been out in the orchard, like hopefully many of my listeners, and picking apples, pressing apples to juice, attending various cider festivals, so I hope you'll excuse the delay. In this interview, I am on location at Franklin County Cider Days in Massachusetts. I had the great fortune of talking with both John Bunker and Rowan Jacobson after their talk on Saturday morning. John Bunker, he's an apple expert, one of the U.S.'s most preeminent apple experts. He's based out of Palermo, Maine. There he runs his own heritage apple CSA program called Out on a Limb. He is the founder of Fedco Trees, where you can order many different heirloom and cider variety apple trees. He is the driving force behind the Maine Heritage Orchard, where varieties that are indigenous to Maine are being planted with the hopes of preserving them for future generations. And he's also the author of Not Far From the Tree, which is a look at the apple and cider culture of Palermo, Maine, and I guess by extension of New England and the country as a whole. And Rowan Jacobson, he is the James Beard Award-winning author of A Geography of Oysters and many other great articles and books. I first came across his work in American Terroir, but his most recent book is on apples. It's called Apples of Uncommon Character, and he's a very talented writer, food writer, travel writer, kind of talking about the sustainability of our food systems. So without further ado, this is our talk at Cider Days from November 1st, 2014. So it's November 1st. We are at Franklin County Cider Days, and I'm very privileged to have two amazing authorities with me here. On my right is John Bunker. You may know him as the founder of Fedco Trees. He is the author of Not Far From the Tree. And on my left is Rowan Jacobson, also a very talented authority. His latest book is Apples of Uncommon Character. Guys, thanks for being here with me today.
Thank you.
So, John, I'm gonna start with you. You guys just did a talk on fruit exploration, and that is something that seems to be very near and dear to your heart. Can you talk us through a little bit about sort of the history of apples in Maine and why it's necessary now to sort of go explore for some of that fruit that was once grown in Maine?
Okay. Well, it's a long history. So, it would have begun before 1600, when fishermen from Europe were fishing off the coast of Maine, and every ship had the apple barrel, and so the apple cores, the apple seeds were deposited into the ocean all over the islands. So off the coast of Maine, you find there were orchards very early on from seed, planted either on purpose or inadvertently by the fishermen from Europe, largely from Portugal. Nobody knows a lot of the details except that we know there were orchards very early on. Then when Europeans began to settle on the coast of Maine and then inland, everybody pretty much lived in some version of a farm. Every farm had an orchard. The orchards were almost exclusively from seed. And because of the biology of an apple tree, every seed is unique. So really what was happening was this what I like to say, great sort of inadvertent breeding experiment where every farmer was an apple breeder, selecting the best of their seedlings and then occasionally naming them and then passing them around from cyanwood, from grafting, because the only way to replicate them is from grafting. So that by the middle of the 19th century, from Maine to Georgia and out to the Mississippi River, there would have been tens of millions of apple seedlings and many, many thousands of named American varieties.
I believe you mentioned in your book that at one point in Maine's history that apples were probably the best land use in terms of making a profit. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. So, and one of the one of the, convenient things about apples is that you could use your marginal land for your apple orchards. Your best farmland would be used for your row crops. Then your probably next best land would be used for your pasturing, and then your rockier land that you would not be able to or didn't want to pull the rocks out, and you definitely didn't want to try to plow it, you could put your orchards in there.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about the transition from seedling fruit to grafting and the New England Seven and sort of a brief history of that? Because something that I noticed in the book is that you felt that the farmers had this sort of self-sufficient lifestyle and they almost kind of had to give that up in a way once they started grafting varieties. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, there was a period when the farming model was one of a small, diversified, mostly self-sufficient farm and community. And in that model, you don't need uniformity and named varieties and those kinds of more modern agricultural elements are way less important, because what you're doing is you're providing for yourselves what you call things, and to some degree the quality just needs to be good enough for you, and that could be an animal. The breeds or not breeds of animals that were used, and the seed that was used for the crops. Because people were not selling products, there was a whole different mindset of how you look at what you produce. As the state survives on taxes, and you can't. It's very difficult to tax people who are living in a subsistence, self-sufficient economic model, because they don't need anything from the state. There were not roads, and so forth. So as the roads began to improve, and this in ways that I don't totally understand has to do with temperance, the temperance movements, and some people feel like the transition from the more self-sufficient model to the more to the sort of more retail model, you might call it, the farm as an economic entity. How much does that have to do with temperance? And because the seedling orchards were ideal for creating cider, and the cider was the perfect drink for the farmers, because they could produce it for nothing on their own farms, and some people think that the temperance movement was about trying to clean up people's behavior because they were drinking too much, but I also wonder if the temperance movement was about the state gaining control over the farm as a way of generating income through taxation. Because, as I said, if you're producing everything on your own farm for your own use, how can you tax that? But starting around 1830 or so, and then progressing throughout the 19th century, there was this movement, for whatever the reason was, away from the seedling self-sufficient type farm model to the grafted tree, and then to also as you sell more of a product, there is the necessity for your customer to be able to recognize what it is that you're selling, especially if you're not selling it on your farm. And what we could have done is we could have had a model where in this valley, these apples were grown, in that valley, those apples were grown, and so forth, similar to the way of different wines in Europe or cheeses or, you know, whatever. But instead, we slowly moved ourselves towards the commodity version of in this case, orcharding, where instead of having, you know, millions of seedlings, we then went to thousands of varieties, named varieties, a few of which were recognizable over a large, large geographical area. And then from there to a reduced number of recognizable varieties down to seven in 1927 or so, and then down to only a small handful, I like to say, after 1934 and the big freeze in 1934.
So Rowan, I guess where your book picks up is where we do have the grafted varieties, the named varieties. How did you go about selecting the varieties for your book? Was there a sense of trying to find things that you enjoyed and wanted to repopularize? Or what was the sort of thought process, I guess, in picking the apples that are in the book?
Yeah, well, it was one, to just to give people a tool to learn more about whatever apples they were coming across. So I tried to make sure that the main apples they were coming across were in there. But I also wanted to sort of take that conversation to the next level. So I also really wanted to include apples that they were unlikely to come across, and that apples that had a really good reason that it would be worth seeking out. So
right.
Either because they were, just incredibly delicious, or had a particularly interesting story to tell that helps kind of tell the overall story of the apple. Or sometimes there's a few in there that are purely in there just because it's an awesome picture.
Yeah.
You know? And they might not even taste that great, but they also just helps to, you know, I'm basically trying to get that moment where people go, you know, their mind kind of clicks open and they start thinking about the apple in a different way.
So I know that apple books are very popular. Was it very intimidating to kind of jump into a topic like this that a lot of people have done and worried about, sort of like, you know, I guess you reached out to John and probably to people like Tom Burford. Like, was this an intimidating topic because so many people have covered it? And, you know, that's the idea of apples being as American, you know, as a fruit can get. Was that
right,
a challenge
right.
for you? Or
no, it wasn't intimidating, because one of the reasons I wanted to do the book is because I saw that there was this gap to be filled. Like, there are apple books out there that were, you know, guides to varieties, but they were really mostly written by pros for maybe the backyard gardener. And I felt like there wasn't anything out there that was speaking to, you know, the Whole Foods shopper who might not ever grow a tree in her life, but had an interest in food. And with this book, she might then start to develop a whole different relationship with apples.
Right.
So that hadn't been done. That was kind of wide open. And so I was coming at it from the consumer end. And didn't necessarily need to be an expert in the same way. Like, there's this, you know, the famous sort of dictum about writing: write what you know. And more, I think that's true for fiction. It's really important with fiction that you write what you know, because you have to convince people of the authenticity of what you're writing about. But with nonfiction, I think it should be write what you don't know. Because when you're new to a subject, it's magical to you. And you're just, like, fascinated by it in the same way that the casual reader is going to be fascinated by it. And sometimes when you're too close to a subject, you kind of forget what was interesting about it to outsiders in the first place. Like, I've noticed this is with oysters. My first book was about oysters, and at that time I was writing about what I didn't know. And since then, I've come to know everything about oysters so well, because it kind of goes on and on. I know all the grower, I know the whole industry part of it, and I think I probably don't write as well about oysters now, because I forget. I get into some, like, little, like, minor trivial things that seem huge to me, but the outside reader can care less about, and I forget the big picture, you know?
So I guess that's why we call them enthusiasts, right? Because you have to be enthusiastic about something. Once you progress to being an expert, maybe you lose some sort of that enthusiasm, perhaps.
Yeah, sometimes you just don't see the forest for the trees because you've made it to the center of the trees, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe that's who your best critic is too, because I know when I write, the person that I want to read it first to tell me about it before it goes out somewhere is the person that doesn't know much about it.
Exactly.
You know, because then they can look at it and say, you know, this does not make sense or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, for it's like you need to be able to describe something to your grandmother or something like if you have like a business idea, you need to be able to describe it to somebody who clearly does not keep up with trends and that sort of thing. Well, let me ask you guys this. I'll throw it out to both of you. Are you surprised that hard cider is one of the sort of the catalysts for generating interest in these uncommon varieties? Like, John, did you ever thought that that would be something that would, you know, get people interested in what you're doing, that hard cider would ever experience a sort of renaissance like it has?
Well, I pressed, when I was rather young, I pressed a lot of cider. While I was pressing cider and selling some and selling barrels to my friends and so forth, I found myself thinking about agriculture in general and orcharding, and how could we create a way of using apples that would be profitable for the orchardist. Because 20 or 30 years ago, the orchardists, like many other farmers, were basically just a dying breed. And one commercial orchardist told me that they were selling their juice apples to one of these big juice companies for like 3 cents a pound or something. I mean, whatever it was just disgraceful. You know, it was costing more money to produce the apples and not even pick them than it would be to sell them. And so I spent a lot of time just out, you know, by myself in old orchards, old trees and so forth, and I'd always be sort of musing about these things. And the one thing that I always came back to was alcohol. And that was one way that I thought that someday there could be a revival of the whole apple industry. But I didn't, you know, I struggled with it because of all the stuff about alcohol, you know, that, you know, should you drink, blah, 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 blah. So then maybe 15 or whatever years ago, I started to hear about Steve Wood. And so I went and visited him, talked a lot about cider. He was the one who really introduced me to the English and British, the British and French cider apples. I started to get signwood from him, started to graft trees, and still I thought, this is interesting, it's fun, and it is part of a really, really small scale, sort of almost amateur way of using apples. And then all of a sudden it just, you know, it crept along at a snail's pace. And then it reached that, you know, 100th monkey or whatever, and it just took off. And I guess I'm not totally surprised. I'm more delighted than surprised. I was at CiderCon in Chicago last February, and there was this salon type of thing. It was after CiderCon the next day. On the Navy Pier, and there was this just gigantic room on Navy Pier, and it was packed with people. I mean, you were like, you know, a foot away from the person nearest you, and the entire thing was cider, with cider makers all around the perimeter, and Steve Wood was there, and it was just this like chaos of people drinking and talking. And so I went up to Steve and I said, 10 years ago, would you have ever believed that this would have happened? Because he was just like sort of like out in the dark, sort of you know, calling. and he said, 2 years ago, I wouldn't have believed this was ever going to happen. So it's probably similar to what happened to beer, except that it already happened to beer. And so, with that transition from sort of Budweiser to craft beer, and now I think that it's happened once, this version of it is going to happen a lot more quickly, because people are get it that the apple juice version of hard cider is an interesting thing, but it's going to be a lot more fun to make it more sophisticated. So it's just rolling now at this point. There's in Maine, I would say probably every month there's a new commercial cider maker in Maine with an actual license and products to sell and so forth. It's just unbelievable.
That's excellent. So let's close with this. So Rowan, I'll throw this to you first. What does cider have to do in order to stay in the public consciousness and to continue growing the way it is? Like, what obstacles does cider have to overcome in order to reach widespread acceptance in the U.S.?
Yeah, I do think it has some obstacles. I'm also shocked that it is becoming as mainstream as quickly as it is, because I started making my own cider, I guess it's like 10, 11 years ago, and I fermented it out dry, just sort of very classic, you know, farmhouse cider, and 4 out of 5 people that I loved it. I thought it was fascinating, but 4 out of 5 people who tasted it did not love it. It's a dry cider is still a weird drink to most people, I think. So somehow the industry has been, and you, like John was saying, Steve Wood, his cider is off-putting to a lot of people who have never had anything like that. It's just such, it's clearly not, people think it's going to be white wine or something sweet when they taste it, and it's not either one of those things. You know, it is its own entity, which is great. That's partly why I love it so much. But what's it going to be as we go forward? I don't think anyone knows, and it's interesting. This is the redoubt for the dry ciders. You go out to the Pacific Northwest to their cider fests, and it's a completely different drink and a completely different atmosphere. So it's going to be really interesting to see. And I know internally the industry is really wrestling with this, like, because some ciders are more like the wine coolers of 2014, you know, a sweet, very simple drink. Some are bone dry, and then some are like the craziest craft beers with, you know, like, you can, there's these like guava ciders out there, and like every flavored cider you can think of is now being made artisanally by somebody in Portland, Oregon or somewhere like that. So there's so little definition of what cider is, and that's going to be, I think, maybe a problem down the line to a certain extent. Or maybe it's all going to shake out and there's just going to be, you know, several different branches of the tree that cider follows, and each branch has its own following, you know.
And some of it may hinge upon the success of these varieties getting planted again. John, do you think is that something that's maybe holding the industry back right now, that there aren't widespread access to some of the apples that cider makers would like to use to make cider with? Like,
yes, the lack of sufficient quantities of more complex flavored varieties is a big issue right now. That people, some orchardists are planting thousands of cider varieties because the sort of Max and Cortlands and Golden Delicious and those sort of apples, they're very good apples to practice on as you're learning how to make cider, but because there's no hops in, or, you know, rarely hops is used in cider or other sort of additives, it's all about the apples. So for those that want to, really, no matter what you want to do with your cider, it's going to be about largely about the varieties. It's sort of the difference between having one of those little watercolor packs that has like six colors in it and then becoming, you know, a sort of a more sophisticated artist where you need like 100 different tubes of color. And so right now, people are trying to, as rapidly as possible, plant the European cider varieties that have more tannins and, you know, so forth, and go through existing American varieties and try to find ones that would be good in cider, and discover new varieties from seedlings that are out there in the landscape, because many of them have a lot of flavors and that will come through the fermenting process. So in a way, it's sort of a renaissance of apple orcharding that is accompanying the cider making, which I think will be really exciting.
And what a wonderfully unlikely problem to have, that, you know, you can't get enough Dabinette.
right. You can't get enough of some weird, you know, that you can't even eat fresh, and people just want it.
Yeah, after, like, you know, yeah, to see these, you know, like hipsters with their Kickstarter campaigns so that they can like create these cider orchards of this thing that no one's thought of in 150 years. It's, I don't know, you know, it's like Tony Bennett. It was out of fashion for so long that suddenly it got rediscovered by the kids.
Well, it's an exciting time for apples and it's an exciting time for cider. And thank you guys for joining me today. So Rowan Jacobson, John Bunker, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ray.
Thanks, Eric.
It was a great pleasure for me to sit down with John and Rowan, and I hope you enjoyed that interview. I would highly suggest reading both of these guys' work. A good place to start might be the piece that Rowan did on John in Mother Jones magazine back in 2013. The title is Why Your Supermarket Sells Only 5 Kinds of Apples. I think it's a great one. Even if you read it, go back and reread it. I think it's fantastic. So that wraps up episode 6. If you'd like to hear more podcasts or find more information about the podcast, go to ciderguide.com/podcast. There I have an episode list. I have information such as the RSS feed for the podcast if you'd like to be informed about future episodes. And I've created a shortcut if you'd like to go to episode 6, ciderguide.com/6. That's ciderguide.com/6. It'll take you to this interview where there's also a transcript posted if you'd like to read this. I also highly suggest that wherever you find this podcast, iTunes, Stitcher, etc., leave a review. It helps people find the podcast, and it can be the best thing you can do to help spread the word about apples and cider. Let me share with you really quickly a review that has been posted to iTunes. It's from listener SGINOR. I've listened to all 5 of Eric's podcasts to date, and I have thoroughly enjoyed each of them. As a home cider maker, I find that I learned several things by listening to Cider Guide. Can't wait for more podcasts. So thank you for the praise. I hope that if you enjoy this, that you will leave a review and help pass along the word. If you'd like to learn more, again, ciderguide.com/podcast. Send me an email. I'm eric@ciderguide.com. That's eric@ciderguide.com. Thank you for listening.